women are still very underrepresented in the fields of planning and architecture and engineering. And, you know, we're not even allowed into many of those fields in the actual academic programs until like the early 70s, depending on where you were and who you were and so forth.
I'm John Lewis, and you're listening to 360 Degree City, a podcast where we talk to all kinds of folks that are making life in cities better. Our hope is at the end of each episode, you'll start to see your own city from a slightly different angle. In the last two episodes, we've talked to two urbanists who are in politics. Our guest today is also advocating for political change. It's really important to have a diverse set of people at the table when it comes to urban planning, design, architecture, and municipal politics. Historically speaking, marginalized groups have had limited input into how our cities are built. In 1961, Jane Jacobs wrote that cities have the capability of providing something for everybody only because and only when they are created by everybody. Equitable representation is a political issue in Canada's national government as well. In 2015, Canada's newly elected Liberal government made headlines by selecting the first gender-balanced cabinet in the country's history.
Understand one of the priorities for you was to have a cabinet that was gender balanced. Why was that so important to you?
Because it's 2015.
Earlier this year in Calgary, City Council debated whether councillors should be able to take parental leave while in office. Our recent guest, Councillor Jyoti Gontek, had some strong words for a fellow councillor who questioned the validity of granting parental leave to councillors.
I delivered a baby and then delivered a report 3 weeks later. I am appalled that somebody would say you cannot represent your constituents because you have a child. Unbelievable to me. There are prime ministers in other nations that are having babies and still able to lead. I think a council member should be able to do that.
By the way, council voted 13-1 to direct staff to explore various considerations and options of parental leave for city councillors in Calgary. We wanted to talk to someone who's an advocate for addressing women's issues in cities.
My name is Katrina Johnston Zimmerman. I'm an urban anthropologist, and I am the co-founder of Women-Led Cities here in Philadelphia. And my own incentive for this is certainly political. I will not deny that. Everything we do really is political. I think that urbanism is this sort of niche subject, but I really like elevating that to a higher level of conversation because it is literally our entire world now. We are an urbanized species.
Through her observational methods as an urban anthropologist, Katrina is working to make cities more inclusive. In this episode, Katrina and I talk about how she understands cities through the lens of an urban anthropologist, some shifts that have occurred in cities over time, the importance of advocating for women-led cities, and how cities can become more equitable. Let's dive in. So as an urban anthropologist, I'm excited to chat with you about that perspective. So how does being an urban anthropologist inform how you view a city?
Yeah, absolutely. I come from cities as an anthropologist strictly. So a lot of my interest in cities came from really actually studying our earliest cities. And it was through looking at a lot of open space in those contexts compared to now, as well as specifically public space, that I really started to think about the way our cities are formed in relation to, you know, human behavior and how the built environment impacts our lives and we impact it and so on and so forth. So as an anthropologist, I think sometimes I take a long view of things. I also think kind of far into the future. And I think very globally, and that's sort of just, I think, by default. So it's a lot about context. It's a lot about patterns. And then it's also a lot about evidence-based everything, which, in my opinion, should just be standard in urbanism anyway. But that's really where I come from.
Yeah, that evidence-based piece seems to be gaining more traction, but it's surprisingly novel in a lot of ways. So on your website, you mention this measurement, responsible measurement, evidence-based design, and humanist intent. Could you explain what that means and maybe describe for folks what are some of the tools that you would use when you go out into an urban space to understand it better?
What I do in public spaces is kind of like a quick ethnography of a place. So you can't do a full ethnography on, you know, the entire neighborhood per se. You can do planning workshops and charrettes and other, you know, surveys and things that can capture the interest and the understanding of what the community is and what they want. But you can also take a look at the space and see how it flows. And there's always this kind of like pattern of usage, you know, early day, midday, night, different seasons, different types of people and uses. And you can basically look at what's being done and what isn't being done to also additionally inform the process behind whatever design or programming changes are going to take place. So even though I don't have the survey data per se every time, you know, what I'm giving you is a story of the place and hoping that it is taken with the same kind of, you know, severity with which I conduct that research. The easier way of explaining what I do after that extremely lengthy explanation is I'm basically a professional people watcher. So I can tell, you know, if somebody's comfortable, or I can kind of notice patterns of behavior like, oh, there's lots of people in groups or not or whatever, and activity. But, you know, the kind of observational insight that you can glean from those things can really best be told in the story. And I think that that is actually very accessible. And sometimes it's just a quick little snapshot, which is normally what I put down on Instagram or something like that. But in a report context, it's just very much so, you know, these are the people, these are the activities. It's just sort of describing what maybe a local would experience, but may not actually be able to explain in the same kind of way.
Okay, great. Can you describe some of the cultural differences you've observed, whether that be in different regions of the US or different parts of the world? That's one of the things I'm curious about and am admittedly pretty ignorant about in terms of the cultural dynamic that a place might have from a, you know, let's say a national perspective, and how that translates to use of space and understanding of space. An example would be that in the fall I was in Spain for a few weeks, and one of the things I observed was how many seniors were out walking. And obviously that's a function of the built environment that enables that, but it also is a habit that's formed over a lifetime. Those folks, you obviously didn't just wake up at 75 and start walking. Can you maybe describe some of those insights that you've seen in various, like I say, regions in the States or across different parts of the world you've been to?
Mm-hmm. The elderly use of public space is also very common in places like Latin America and South America. I think that it's interesting because, again, form influences behavior, right? And so if you don't have a nice place to stroll through, you know, as an elderly person, as the example, then you're not going to have that kind of culture because it's just literally unavailable. So you have to sort of think about what has existed for a long period of time as well. And also, I would say, to your point, older folks have a greater culture of person-to-person contact than a lot of younger people do. You know, this public square in a lot of these places, that's where you got all of your information, right? So there's this culture of, you know, after dinner, you go to the central square, you play a game, you have a drink, you talk to your friends, you people watch, and that's just sort of built in. But that's something that can be learned as well. That's the whole point.
So that's interesting with you mentioning the role of memory and lived experience. When we talked to Cornelia Dinka a few episodes ago about the evolution of Amsterdam turning into a bicycle mecca, and of course people assume that it used to be, or it's always been that way, but it obviously wasn't. And when that shift was happening in the early 70s, some of the leaders of making the city a more people-friendly and cycle-friendly community were actually people that could remember how it was before the city was built around the automobile. So that idea of collective memory can be really important. And, you know, over time, when you have enough experience in a certain type of city, so for example, cities that are built around cars, there might be entire generations, so there is no living memory of what a city is like without it being focused on the car, for example.
Yeah, I'm one of those early stage millennials. So I remember the transition over from like no internet to dial up to smartphone. So I can get that from a technological like standpoint. But you're right. Like when we're born, we so quickly adapt to our like cultural context. So it's like you emerge in this world and you're like, there are roads and stoplights and I get around by car and, you know, you don't really think outside the box in that sense unless you do see the alternative and how much better it is.
Terrific. One of the things I wanted to chat with you about were your articles and your conversations and presentations that really do a great job of putting a spotlight on how cities have been historically planned and designed by men. Can you describe that process over time and what the impact has been on our cities?
Yeah. So anthropologically, again, thinking about our urban context, we've only lived in cities for about 10,000 years. And that, I think, is incredibly important to keep in mind. And that may sound like a long time, but, you know, we've been anatomically modern humans for 200,000 years. We've been evolving for millions of years. This planet has been around for, you know, 4.5 billion years, you know, and it's just sort of one of those things to, you know, put everything in perspective, I guess. But in the urban context, however, when we shifted from hunter-gatherers over to settle down permanently, which happened in modern day Turkey around the what is commonly referred to as the Fertile Crescent, we essentially started building our own habitats. And we've kind of done that temporarily in certain places as well. And, you know, again, over time, this was in different stages depending on where you were. Like North America, for instance, had a totally different pattern or whatever. But so when we transitioned over from hunter-gatherers, we sort of just made like compounds of buildings like close together. But eventually something changed. And I've been told it's about like roughly a couple thousand years as something started changing. And while the earliest cities were very egalitarian, it seems like hierarchies, specialization of labor, you know, control structures, systems of cultural norms like religion and governance, something came into play that eventually started pushing women down in some capacity. And that's society, but it also, of course, reflected itself in our built environment as well. You know, again, our environment reflecting our values as society, right? So over the next several thousand years, essentially every city that you see, because of this, you know, ongoing male dominance in society, ended up being just male-dominated cities as well. So there are definitely examples, again, like some cultures were making their own buildings, you know, bottom-up for a very long period of time. You know, some places did a really good job, I think, probably of, you know, having a nice balance of spaces for different activities and so forth. But especially in the modern context, women are still very underrepresented in the fields of planning and architecture and engineering. And, you know, we're not even allowed into many of those fields in the actual academic programs until like the early 70s, depending on where you were and who you were and so forth. So I've sort of decided to focus on this in a way because, again, I think a lot about the future of our cities. And I really do want to ensure that we are making them as best as possible for us as humans. But there's this lack of representation from the female perspective that I think has to be addressed first in order to really close that gap and ensure that we're making humanist cities.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe some of the impacts? I think, you know, listening to some of your podcasts, reading your writing, you really make a very clear case that this is really about creating equitable cities. Can you describe some of the impacts of this history and how cities have been built in less equitable or inequitable ways?
Essentially, one of the reasons why myself and my partner, Megan, decided to focus on women in this context, too, is because one of the theories is if you focus on women as a sort of second class group of individuals in urbanism, you will also feed over into a lot of other marginalized groups. And so since there's so much to tackle with regards to equity in our cities and in our United States context in particular, at the very least, we can get to gender parity And then that also leads over into other abilities, ethnic identities and groups, other gender identities, and so on and so forth. So that's the hope in any case. I also will say that I feel like a lot of it has to do with policy, despite the fact that, you know, so policy impacts, of course, our design. So one of the examples I'll give for policy in the Philadelphia context is actually a transportation policy. So SEPTA is our transportation system, and the bus system in particular actually has a rule on its books that does not allow strollers of any size to be taken onto a bus while open. So as a mom, I'm not a mom, but as a mom on a street has a child in a stroller with a bag, with a whatever, the kid's half asleep, you know, the mom's been waiting for the bus for how long, you know, she has to take him out of the stroller. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of drivers, and I've seen this happen before, of course, they just, you know, let you on. But the fact that that rule exists on a book somewhere is a little disheartening. There are some examples like that. There are also some examples of representation, just very simply. You know, we in our urban environments hold people up on literal pedestals through our public statues and our public spaces, right? So you look at these public figures, and again, in Philadelphia, as an example, we have 1,500 historic individuals represented in our public space, but only two of them are for women who have lived. So the rest are virtues. Women are often represented as truth or justice.
But actual human beings.
I mean, it's flattering, really. But, you know, that... Right. But that, yeah, that kind of lack of representation has an impact on people. And I think that a lot of it are things that you can't recognize on a daily basis, even unless you're looking for it. And some of it, I honestly don't even know. You know, I can't actually even tell you, oh, this plaza was clearly designed by a man because this is here and that's there, or something like that. We just don't even have a lot of examples of how women do things necessarily to really say for sure, oh, well, this is male or this is female or whatever have you.
What you're doing is shining a light on so many things that folks take for granted. Because if you just looked at this, at how a city operates and how people move through a city, they already take a number of things for granted. And then this is another really important layer that people wouldn't even think about unless somebody is shining a light on it. So, yeah, it's really, really fascinating. And I'm glad to see that, the attention that your writing and your podcasting is getting. And which leads me to the next, thing I'd like to chat with you about is the Women Led Cities Initiative. Can you maybe describe how that came about? And, you had your first conference in March, I believe. And if you could talk about what some of those big takeaways were.
So we had an amazing, 48 hours or so. It was really long. It was so exhausting. But we had a really great group of women that we sort of hand curated in order to get a diversity of a lot of different intersections in the room together. So it was women only in the fields of planning and architecture, but also things like policy, arts. I had a street artist come from Philly who was amazing. Obviously research as well, engineering, real estate, which is hard to find, developers and so forth in commercial real estate. And so we all got together, different ages, ethnicities, identities and experience levels, and hashed out a lot of stuff in that amount of time. So we're still unpacking the results. But we're going to be putting on three more here in Philadelphia over the next year. So we're planning all that right now, too. We want to create essentially a kit of parts. So that way, if you are a like-minded woman in your city and you'd like to start something and have this conversation there as well, then you can do that. It's definitely something that is a hot topic right now. So there's a lot of support for it in a really great way. And then eventually want to lead up to some sort of national or international conference where we can have a platform for discussion for all of these, you know, issues, but also constructive knowledge sharing with regards to research, how you did it in your city, good policies and programs that have been implemented, success stories, and so on.
Terrific. That's exciting to hear that it's not just sort of a an amazing 48 hours that happened at one point in time, and if there's some momentum building. Can you talk about any insights or inspirational moments from the inaugural get-together?
I was actually kind of surprised about how much of it was introspective, which, I mean, I shouldn't be surprised because that's what drove me to this subject matter. And so much of it is based around your personal experience in the workplace, again, like, or in the field, or in your, you know, working knowledge, like whoever you're working with all the time, like the city or a company or whatever, as well as just the city street, you know. And there's so many different areas to tackle this issue on, you know, whether it's top down policy, whether it's, again, like individual workplace settings or so forth. It's kind of daunting, to be perfectly honest. But I think that more than anything else, it's actually an issue that you can take up and do yourself. And that includes men, of course, right? So, like, if you're in charge of a conference, for instance, you know, you're making a committee to review all the proposals and so on and so forth. Just, like, make sure that committee is 50-50 male-female, you know? Work on the diversity beyond that, but, like, in the field, whether it's architecture or planning or whatever, do something like that. Or ensure that your selection process is such that your panelists and your keynote speakers are also 50-50. I'm going to a conference that was low on female attendance for some odd reason, and they're offering a discount. You know, they're like, hey, let's increase the gender equity here. So let's bring more women in. So that's an interesting idea. If you are in any way involved with policy, maybe, you know, a very high level thing to do would be to introduce legislation that says, okay, you know, the council members have to be a 50-50 split or something. I don't know. It's kind of difficult. Or if you're in the policy world and you're an urbanist, like propping up the women who are running for council seats and so on. Because again, this is incredibly political. A lot of the changes that do happen, you know, to bike lanes or to housing policies or zoning codes or whatever, that's all, you know, city level politics too, right? Yeah, so hopefully I'll be able to summarize more of that soon. But I will say that when I talk to women about these issues, about cities in particular, young women in particular, but not exclusively, of course, I get a lot of comments about a city being more holistic in terms of how they view it. Also, they take into consideration multidisciplinary things far more often, I think. One of my favorite Jane Jacobs quotes is actually that you can't, like, change what you don't like, or you can't hope to help what you hate. And, you know, when it comes to changing, you know, cities, which are people, you know, cities are people, you can't do that unless you love the people you're planning for. And I think that we really do need to have that sense of empathy and compassion in our urban environments, if we have any real hope of changing them for the better.
Well, terrific. And thank you for giving some really concrete, actionable ideas, because I know that once you start to go down the path of trying to broaden the understanding of the challenges, then you can stall out pretty quickly of just, over, like you say, being overwhelmed of where the hell to start. So thank you for those specific actions. Yeah, that's really important. yeah, and there's it's always the best session at any conference or what have you when there's, you know, the panel on diversity and it's all a bunch of white dudes.
There's a hashtag for that too, by the way. Mantle.
Mantle. Okay.
A male panel.
Yeah.
I didn't make that.
Okay, that's good to know.
I can't take credit for that. But also, I would say, like, a quick note on that as well. I think, you know, I mean, you are a white male. I am a white female also. You know, again, we have to also be thinking about the rest of the diversity in the conversation. And then also on top of that, you know, a lot of my best friends are, like, young white male urbanists, right? I mean, we're all trying to make cities better. It's just a matter of making sure that you have a diversity of opinions present and actually making the decisions so that way it can be better for everyone. So it's certainly not any kind of antagonistic thing, that's for sure. That's the last thing I want people to think. Is that it's some sort of anti-male anything, because, you know, obviously some of my, you know, main idols in urbanism in history have been men.
Awesome point. And one of the things that to one of your earlier points was that if we can make sure to make it work for women or any variety of folks. We just did a podcast that talked about this funicular project in Edmonton that really took into account folks with mobility challenges to get from the top of downtown to the river valley. So actually the design of the funicular was intentional in terms of the size of that funicular enabled a bicycle with a kid cart in the back. And it was also designed to, with additional cost and things like that, that it was drive in, drive out. So folks with mobility challenges didn't have to work around. So, you know, to consider folks that may have some form of disadvantage in whatever capacity, if policies are working against them, what have you, that could only make a city more inclusive. So, yeah, I think it's not an antagonistic thing. And if folks take it that way, then that sheds a little light on perhaps their perspective.
Right.
So we close out with the same question for everybody. If you could share a city that you love in the world and why you love it.
Oh, that's such a great question. Okay. Okay. But wait, one in contemporary time.
Whoa. Hold on. Hold on.
Or one from history, because you are, you know.
Well, I've never talked to an anthropologist on the podcast before, so hey, if you want to go back in time, that would be cool.
Okay, well, so I'm going to cheat. I'm going to do one from now and one from before, and I'll make it quick. So my one from now, because I do think that they both showcase different things. My one from now is Stockholm, Sweden. I am an unashamed Scandophile, and Scandinavia in particular was actually where I got a lot of my inspiration for livable cities. Much like everyone else, I've traveled to Copenhagen, I've been to Malmö, Stockholm, Norway, various cities there too, and that really, really inspired me to try and make society better for people, because quite frankly, they did a lot in that capacity, and they have created some of the happiest places to live in the world right now. So there's that. But my ancient city, my ancient city is actually one of the earliest cities. It's called Çatalhöyük in modern day Turkey. And the reason why I love that one so much is because it was during that transition period, it seems, from hunter-gatherers. It was, you know, literally one of the first cities from hunter-gatherers to, you know, fully settled society. And as far as we can tell, it was completely egalitarian in the way that it was run. So through burial records, we can see that male and female individuals were buried at the same amount of material goods with the same level of respect. It seems as though children were raised not in their own household exclusively. It was a very village-centered kind of child rearing, which is what they do in hunter-gatherer societies as well. It was just, yeah, this like cluster of buildings where the public space was the top of the buildings, because all the buildings were actually touching one another. So there were holes in the top of the building that you entered through ladders. So if we can find our way back to that, but not, you know, obviously not back to that, because it was like population 7,500 at its peak, I think. but if we can find our way back to the kinds of humanist values that we had during our earliest cities and apply those to today, I think that we can solve these urban issues that we have.
Very cool. Well, this has been great, but now it's a cherry on top with going back in time for the favorite city question. That hasn't happened before. Awesome. I really appreciate Katrina's historic and observational approach to making cities more equitable. I'm excited to learn about the key takeaways from the Women-Led Cities Conference once Katrina sorts through all the great information she collected. 360 Degree City is created by the team at Intelligent Futures. To learn more about the work we do, you can go to intelligentfutures.ca. The music in this episode and in all our episodes is by Sound of Picture. If you like the podcast, please share it with someone that might be interested in seeing their own city from a different angle. We would love it if you subscribed and reviewed the podcast, and would love to hear your feedback. If you have any suggestions for future guests or topics that you'd like us to cover, get in touch with us on our website or any of our social accounts. I'm John Lewis. Thanks for stopping by.